Well, hello there, Todd.
Hello, John. And a little departure from our usual way we open the show. We're going to give you a heads up on what we're going to talk about today, and then we're going to go right into it. We have two events to talk about, one very recent, which happened only 2 days before we recorded the show, where there was an evacuation of a 757 in Atlanta. Fortunately, no one was seriously injured, but there is plenty of lessons to be learned, and especially based on the fact that one of the passengers shot a video of the evacuation. And the second one goes a little bit further back. And John, I think you know a little bit more about this than I do.
We have a Pan American Airways aircraft that crashed in 1952 off the coast of Puerto Rico. And what really piqued my interest in this one was that it was an engine failure, number three engine. And we'll get into all the disclosed about that. But being a maintenance person, as soon as they saw that they knew we had to take a good look at this one. And the reason why it's even bubbling up to the surface after all this time is that the fuselage, the wreckage, has just been discovered off the coast of Puerto Rico. I think by accident. So we'll get into it when we come back.
But before we get into both of those events, we'd like to have a word about our sponsor, Avemco. When you call Avemco, you speak directly with aviation underwriters, not agents or brokers. Whether you're buying an airplane, renewing coverage, or just exploring your options, Avemco is there for you. Call 888-879-0389 or visit www.avemco.com/flightsafety for a free quote. Tell them the flight safety detective sent you, and you get a 5% discount. And now, back to the show. As promised, we have two events to talk about today. The first is an evacuation of a Delta 757. It was an excellent evacuation in the sense of the airplane had some difficulties shortly after takeoff. They came around, did a landing, had the airplane standing upright on all of its wheels, and they evacuated the aircraft. And for those of you watching the video version of this, you're seeing a video shot by one of the passengers who was inside the aircraft. And you'll notice several things as we talk about this. One of them being the passengers was shooting this from inside the aircraft during the evacuation. As we've said before, in situations like this, yes, this kind of information is very valuable to evaluate how well evacuations are going and what lessons can be learned from them. It's not a good thing in the sense of if you're a passenger, you're evacuating an aircraft. Your number one priority is to get the heck out that aircraft and get to a safe position. Then you take out your camera and start recording. That said, there are other things about this which you'll see as we continue talking about it. One of them being that not everyone is just leaving with their clothing and shoes and whatnot. Some people are taking other items, backpacks, coats, etc. Even though this seems to be not a real emergency situation in the sense of nothing's on fire, nothing's exploding. And from looking at the video, I can see at least five and possibly six evacuation slides had deployed. There were roughly 200 people on board the aircraft, so there was plenty of time and plenty of resources with respect to slides to get out of the aircraft. And you can see that people are getting off in a not well. They're not getting off slowly and they're not trying to rush. They're getting off fairly quickly. But afterwards, a couple of things here. The passengers seem to be hanging out near the airplane, and there's sort of a distance shot from this video. You can see there's a group on the right side of the aircraft where this video is being shot, and a group on the far side of the aircraft. Later on, you'll see some of the crew members, apparently one of the flight crew members, and at least one cabin crew member, organizing the people on the right side of the aircraft to get into three different lines and apparently to get them away from the aircraft. This is good. There was also a firefighter in the scene as well who is standing by and not assisting. So it looks like the flight crew and the cabin crew had it together. It looks like this was an evacuation that went according to plan. After we recorded this episode, we came across a video that showed that this was not the case. This video shows three passengers who exited the aircraft with some of their baggage. The person doing the selfie video, the passenger ahead of that person, and the passenger behind that person. Unfortunately, the third person seems to have been injured during the evacuation. We do hope that the person fully recovered and that anyone who sees this video learns something about how to evacuate from an aircraft.
You know, the NTSB, we always went after survival factors. And as I was looking at the video, I don't think there was any way possible to criticize this flight crew in any way. The flight attendants clearly were shouting their orders, clearly maintaining control. And they were probably frustrated as hell as people were bringing in backpacks and other goods with them, which is crazy. You know, I participated in one accident in particular where we had two people actually fist fighting over who was going to go first out the door in the evacuation and slow the evacuation down. And we had a number of fatalities in that event. The airplane was on fire and the bodies were laid in a line at that exit. And so, although the NTSB never went there, in the back of my mind, I always felt that that action may have cost one person behind them the time it would have taken to get out to that and exit the airplane before they were overcome by smoke. So, I mean, it's not only what you're doing for yourself, it's what happened to the people that are behind you. Are you slowing them down? Are you causing a delay, which means the persons further back may not make it out? I mean, it's crazy what these passengers are doing. We saw them in the San Francisco event. Thank God there was no fire with the 777 that landed shot, just a little bit shot, and took the landing gear off. And people were coming down the slide with their suitcases, not just even their backpacks, with their suitcases, rollerboards. I mean, you got to leave that stuff behind. The thing that you need to be thinking about at that moment is getting yourself and everyone else out of that airplane. And I don't know what we're going to do with all that, what the industry is going to do with all of that, because it's certainly not getting better. We saw in Japan, an accident occurred some years ago in Japan, where the actual last person getting out of the airplane, I think it was 15 minutes, whatever the number was, it was way too long to get out of the airplane. And they were all taking their goods with them. So it's just, I don't know what the answer is, but we got to figure out a way to stop it. We've taken the baggage out of the bin because we charge fees to put it in the check baggage. And now we've got huge pieces and heavyweight pieces in the overhead, and people want to grab them and take them with them. It's not so easy sometimes. It's just very perplexing.
And I'll add something else about this. We're talking about this evacuation, but it's highly unlikely this evacuation will show up in any accident or incident report, because if there are no serious injuries, no serious damage to the aircraft, and this is, in essence, a garden variety evacuation. Yes, it was a precautionary evacuation. No, there was not any serious damage to the airplane or serious injuries to people. Therefore, it's not going to be an official accident report. However, as you probably get from listening to us today, there are takeaways from this. You as a passenger, just think, what can you do to prevent this from happening? For example, if you have something extremely valuable and very small, keep it on your person, jewelry, wallet, etc. If you have something that you really don't want to part with, you got to say to yourself, look, plan ahead of time. If I have this laptop in my backpack and a laptop burns up, have I backed up my data somewhere? If I have some very valuable papers traveling with me, am I keeping them on my person, or do I even need to travel with these papers?
You know, and you can have jackets. They sell vests today. You know, I saw this recently. I actually thought about buying one. They sell vests with a bunch of pockets on the inside. So you could put your phone and your passport and your money and your credit cards inside this vest that then is very tight to your body. And that way you're taking your valuables with you no matter where you go. And you can leave your bag behind. So there's a number of alternate things that you can do that will allow you to leave the bag behind. And if you got important documents, scan them, right? So that you have two copies.
And with that, we go to a blast from the past. In fact, let me do some math here. 74 years in the past, from 1952, well before you were at the NTSB, well before I think you were even involved in any aspect formally in aviation.
That's true. That's true.
So why the heck are we talking about it, you might ask? Well, very recently there was an expedition to look for a Pan Am DC-4 that crashed in the ocean off Puerto Rico back in 1952. And it was recently found. It was in the media as being this aircraft that was recovered. And some of the people on board died. Some of the people survived. And you might ask, well, is the NTSB going to investigate this? And John, you gave me a couple of great reasons why that's not going to be the case.
Well, first off, the NTSB has been struggling with money lately, last whole bunch of years. It's not clear. I did some down and dirty on the NTSB's budget with an accountant type person. We looked at it historically and tracked it coming forward, the budget increases they received, and the cost of inflationary costs. That published inflationary costs during that same period of time. And we came up with the NTSB's budget is actually down by some 20%, over 20%. I think the number we came up with was 27%, but I was going to lowball it. But in any event, the budget is down. The present chairman has been talking about the budget shortfalls for the last couple of years. They just don't have the money to do everything that they would like to do. So, and the NTSB budget is heavily on manpower. You know, we have our own facility, so we're not contracting out to anybody. Our own labs, you know, the flight data recorder lab and metallurgy labs and all the rest. So, the money's not going out. It's going to government employees to do their work, and they just don't have the money to do it all. Travel eats up a lot of their money. So they're not going to go back and revisit this. But what piqued my interest in it was that this airplane had flown in to Puerto Rico with an engine problem. And they canceled the flight outbound and they worked on it. Local mechanics there in San Juan actually pulled the prop and pulled the nose case off one of the engines. Remember, this is 1952, so it's a piston engine. So we don't hardly see those anymore, these big round engines at least, anymore. So they did a bunch of work to it. And after, I forget how long it was there. It was there for an extended period of time, but they put it back together again. And on takeoff out of there, he took off at 12:11, just a little bit past noon. And less 8 minutes later, he was calling saying he's coming back because that he had a problem. Now, so he had number three engine had a problem, but he also said in a narrative that he had trouble controlling number four. Now, two engines out of a DC-4, two engines are going to be make it very difficult to fly. But I it, all through all this document, it doesn't say why he had number four engine had a problem, what the problem was. Of course, they never recovered the airplane, so they were going on verbals. The accident itself was covered by the Civil Aeronautics Board. NTSB didn't come to life until 1967. So this was a precursor to this was to the NTSB, although they did some pretty good investigations in the CAB days. But you know, you have nothing to go look at when the airplane's so deep in the ocean. So they had to go by what they could figure out. And apparently that wasn't very much. But
And back in the day when the Civil Aeronautics Board was in existence, were they under the control of the equivalent of the FAA back in 1952?
no, FAA wasn't born until 1958. So there was no FAA. It was the Civil Aeronautics Board. They controlled it all,
So there was no
including yesterday.
separation of church and state like you have now between the FAA and the NTSB.
No. And the CAB also told the airlines what runs they could fly and how much they could charge. So they had total control over the industry. So it was a different time. Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
So one of the things about this event is it garnered quite a bit of media attention. In fact, I saw a piece on the Today Show talking about it, and they highlighted the fact that it was essentially a privately funded venture. There were some remotely operated submersibles that were used to find this aircraft, and of course, it was a feel-good kind of story. Yes, people who died 52 years ago, but there was some closure there. And they even mentioned that a flight attendant who helped to evacuate the aircraft back in 1952 is 102 years old, and she was quite happy that there was a closure to this event and that the aircraft was found. And some of the other things I saw online mentioned, wow, this could mean that there's hope for MH370. This was back in March of 2014. The 777 from Malaysian Airlines was taking off from Kuala Lumpur going to China, and it didn't make it. We won't go into the details, but it is widely believed, based on objective information gathered during and after the flight, that it went down somewhere in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Under how many thousands of feet of water, it's unclear. Unlike the Pan Am plane, which I believe sunk in about 2,000 feet of water off of Puerto Rico near San Juan, the part of the Indian Ocean where MH370 is believed to have been lost is much, much deeper. And as you can see from the screen grabs of the Pan Am plane, it was largely intact. It seemed to be inverted in the water with one of its wings missing. And also, the accident report says that there were survivors, including the entire flight crew that was helping passengers to evacuate the aircraft. So the aircraft was largely intact when it hit the water and then sank afterwards. There is no indication whether MH370 landed intact and, let's say, had a controlled ditching, or did not land intact. The evidence that exists right now implies that the aircraft ran out of fuel. And if the aircraft runs out of fuel, there's limited hydraulic and electrical power to power landing gear, flaps, etc. So even if there were pilots at the controls, if they were trying to ditch an aircraft that had run out of fuel for its engines, it would have been quite a bit more difficult than a regular ditching. That said, it's been on the bottom of the ocean for 14 years, not as long as the 74 years as in the case of the Pan Am aircraft. But with no survivors from MH370, 14 years of seawater and environmental effects on whatever wreckage is left down there, based on what you've seen in your career, do you think there's any possibility that there's useful information from the cockpit's voice recorder, the flight data recorder, passenger electronic devices, or even the wreckage itself after 14 years?
Well, that airplane has a digital flight recorder and voice recorder. But under that pressure, 20,000 feet, roughly, a tremendous amount of pressure. So that recorder is probably collapsed inside. Could those chips, that memory chips inside there, maintain their integrity all this time and under that pressure? That's an unknown, but I tend to think no. 20,000 feet is where that airplane has come to rest, approximately. The pressure alone on that flight data recorder and in the sealed portion of the recorder that's supposed to maintain integrity through a fire and through a big crash has probably been crushed, like we crush soda cans. So I think it would be extremely, extremely rare that we'd be able to get any data off of that.
By the way, you mentioned the estimated depth of MH370 is about 20,000 feet. For comparison, the Titanic is on the order of 12,500 feet below sea level. So even if there were either automated or human-rated submersibles going down there to look for it, assuming they could find it, it might be quite difficult to recover anything from it. The closest comparison I can think of is the 2009 event involving an A330 from Air France that went down in the South Atlantic. That was found on the order of a couple of years later, and quite a bit of wreckage was recovered from that one. But that was much less challenging than where MH370 is presumed to have gone down. Plus, there was a much better idea of where that aircraft was. So, although the search did take some time, it was an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude easier than finding MH370. Just to give you an idea, I did a back of the envelope calculation. One of the early search fields when they narrowed things down, the size of the search field was equivalent to the state of Pennsylvania or the country of North Korea. That's how much space it would have to look at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, in mountainous terrain, too. So the terrain itself where the on the bottom of the ocean is not flat. It's not like a sandy bottom. It's all peaks and valleys. So, and that's one of the reasons why the pinging from the recorders didn't get them closer to the airplane in the 30 days they were looking for it. So, because the signal gets swallowed by the surrounding obstacles. And they also have said that that area is covered with silt. And in some of the valleys between the peaks, the silt can be 100 feet deep. So it's quite a challenge. I think eventually we will find it, being able to get anything good out of it from their recorders, I don't think we will.
Well, I've said a variation of this before, and I'll say it again. I firmly believe that eventually MH370 will be found. However, if you are listening to this podcast the year that we're broadcasting this for the first time in 2026, I seriously doubt that anyone who's listening to this in 2026 will be alive when that happens.
I don't think I will be.
Well, this is Vegas on the over under, how many years it would take. Whatever number of years you give, I'd bet on the over. With that happy thought, let's go to my second to last word. And something about both of these gives us something new to think about and something old to think about. In the second case, obviously, the 56-year-old, 54-year-old rather, accident was old, but it gives us new insights as to the difficulty of dealing with contemporary searches. And the newer event, which happened only a few days before we recorded this, is harking back to something old, passenger behavior in evacuations. This is happening not just in the US, but around the world. So we'll keep trying on the second thing. With that, we take you to all of us to the very last word from you, John.
Right. And as usual, I will say, if you're going to go flying, please, please, please do a good job of pre-planning. I just this morning looking at some accidents for future shows, and we've planning and poor planning keeps coming up over and over again. So please do a good job of planning. And recently, I've had somebody call me who has a very interesting program for planning your flights. And I've asked them to come on the show, and they're working out on how to make that happen. So, a very interesting automated program. But again, do a good pre-flight. Do it at home before you go to the airport. Do it at the airport. Make sure they agree. Remember, weather here, there, and everywhere in between. You get out to your airplane, you're the last line of defense for that airplane. You've got to determine the airworthiness of the airplane before you get in it. So do a good pre-flight. All right, we've got a case coming up here pretty soon that we're going to talk about involving an interesting maintenance that was done on an airplane. So we will explore that one. But please keep your eyes open. Todd, you had a great experience years ago, not that many years ago, with an airplane that you found all new hardware on. And you dug into it and found out that they replaced the wing. And you had no clue beforehand that that wing had been replaced. So there's lots of things that are done to airplanes when you're not around them and they're not your airplane. So please pay attention. And when you get in the air, put that head on a swivel. We still have a ton of new pilots out there, and newbies make mistakes. And let them have the room to make the mistakes and not have any consequences. So please, please fly safely.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so, and we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join. Do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flight safety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.